much easier to tell people something new than it is to tell them that something they've always believed is wrong. If somebody were to come down from the Himalayas tomorrow and say, you know, I found this amazing plant and it does all these things and it works with the system of the body responsible for keeping us healthy, people would be all over it. The fact that that plant has already been identified and it happens to be called cannabis changes everything.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cannabis Law on Earth. I'm your host, Russell Bennett, a cannabis lawyer, author, and filmmaker in Toronto. Today, I talk to Dr. Barbara J. Mainville, MD. Following 30 years of practice in emergency medicine and 30 years as a coroner for the province of Ontario, conducting both investigations and inquests, Dr. Mainville has been working with medical cannabis and actively counseling patients for more than 8 years. She is a member of the Canadian Consortium for the Investigation of Cannabinoids, the Society of Cannabis Clinicians, the Western Trauma Association, and the Special Operations Medical Association, as well as serving as the medical director for DBI Tactical. She was a featured guest on the medical cannabis podcast Let's Talk Cannabis and has a particular interest in the potential applications of medical cannabis in physical and psychological trauma, both long-term and acutely. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hello, Dr. Mainville. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited that you're here. We had a conversation months and months ago, and you're an amazing wealth of knowledge. And so I'm glad that you can help our listeners navigate medical cannabis. And yet I before we get into the medical cannabis side of things, which I first heard you speak with Sherry Bennett on her podcast, Let's Talk Cannabis, which everybody should check out. But you're on there for hours and hours explaining you really drill down into some serious detail. But I know we can't get into that kind of level of detail here today. But I do want to give our listeners a brief and a good view on medical cannabis from your perspective and the medical profession.
All right.
So let's start with you first. I know Sherry says Dr. Barb. So can I call you Dr. Barb?
Sure.
Thanks. So Dr. Barb, on your resume, you have listed that you worked at the coroner's office, chief coroner's office of Ontario for almost 30 years. How did you get into the office and why? I don't know, for me, I saw my first dead body when I was in university. I maybe it's just afraid of death, but could you give me some insight into, you know, your journey into the coroner's office maybe?
Okay. So I wasn't actually in the office. I was a coroner for the province of Ontario, in the Eastern region. And the coroners will investigate deaths. Any sudden and unexpected death needs to be reported, and any death by related to trauma. So, for instance, that includes somebody who falls and breaks a hip, and then just continues to dwindle and just never really recovers from that broken hip, that is considered a death from a traumatic cause. So, the whole point is the coroners speak for the dead to protect the living is the coroner's office motto. And so by evaluating and investigating these deaths, we try to put measures in place that will help protect other people and prevent other people from dying under similar circumstances in the future. And there's...
Can you give me an example maybe of a death that you investigated that helped?
Well, one of the ones that went to inquest, I was both an investigating coroner and an inquest coroner. And when I started in the system back in 1987, the investigating coroners actually held the inquest if it was something that that required an inquest or we thought an inquest would be useful. And so one of my cases back then was a fellow who was driving a forklift Turned out he was a casual employee at this factory, his lift truck ended up toppling over, and he was ejected from the seat of the lift truck and crushed by the frame of the lift truck, the overhead frame that is supposed to be there to protect him from things falling on him, fell on him and crushed him. And so we took that case to inquest. It was my second inquest in the summer of 1989. And the inquest process is very interesting process. It's non-adversarial. We're not there to try and lay blame. We're there to look at the circumstances surrounding whichever death is involved. And the jury is tasked with coming up with answers to the questions of who, what, when, where, and how the I resigned after 30 years. I decided it was somebody else's turn to do this work, so I resigned in 2017. But they answer those five questions, and then they have the opportunity to come up with recommendations to hopefully try and prevent deaths under similar circumstances in the future. And if these recommendations are reasonable and valid, they are then sent on to the parties involved. And those recommendations are non-binding, but there certainly is a lot of incentive for the involved party to comply with them, unless there's a very specific reason not to. So any party affected by this will generally either comply, or they will send a reply to the chief coroner's office explaining why they cannot comply with this. If they decide to just ignore the recommendation, then there's not really anything we can do about it, but it does put them in a very awkward position if somebody down the line should happen to die under similar circumstances.
Right.
You know, you knew this was a problem.
Do you remember your recommendations from the forklift?
There were a number of them, and the two that stand out, keep in mind this was back in 1989, so it's not quite fresh in my memory, but the two in particular that stand out in my mind are, one, lift truck operators now need to have training. This person had no training on operating a lift truck. It was just, you know, here, go and do this. So they now need a training certificate that has to be renewed under on a regular basis. I'm thinking it might be every 2 years, but I could be wrong about that. But they do need to have this certification. And also, lift trucks are now required to have seat belts. If when this lift truck had toppled over, he had actually stayed on the seat, he would have been completely fine. So those are the types of things that a coroner's jury might come up with. And certainly over the course of the inquest, we are presented with a lot of different information. And one of the roles of the coroner is to help to interpret this information for the jury and help them assign weight to the information, to the evidence. Sometimes the evidence is conflicting and the jury's in a position where they have to decide which version they're going to believe. So part of my role as coroner is to help them interpret what they're presented with. So that was certainly a very interesting part of my function.
It's amazing you were doing that for almost 30 years, and yet now you're doing something almost completely different, in the sense of maybe you can tell me your pathway into learning about cannabis as a medicine and what you do today.
Okay, so the coroner's work was really just a side job. It was an interesting aspect of what I was doing, but it was not my main employment. After the first 6 years, I was doing a lot of different things. In 1992, it's getting a little hectic and chaotic, and it's like, okay, I have to make some choices here. And so in 1992, I decided that I was going to work solely in emergency medicine. And so from then until 2016, my main employment was in an emergency department. And actually in the town that I grew up in. And
oh, where's that?
Yeah, which has its advantages and disadvantages.
Which town did you grow up in?
Hawkesbury. I was born in Hawkesbury. I grew up in Lorignal, but Lorignal is quite small and doesn't have a lot of services, including schools. So I went to school in Hawkesbury, and so I went back to my hometown. And when I first started working, it was actually with the physician that delivered me. So,
wow! Wow, that's amazing.
So, it was quite interesting. It certainly had its advantages and disadvantages. When I first started working in 1986, the hospital was brand new. It had only been built in 1984. It was quite unusual in that they had a management contract with an American management firm. Prior to that, Hawkesbury had three hospitals. All of them were just financial messes. And the province said, we will help you fund this new hospital, but you have to get your financial house in order. And so they had this management contract with an American management firm. They were not a day-to-day presence in the operation of the hospital. Basically, we paid the management fee. I was also on the board of directors of the hospital for a while, so I do have some insight into how that worked. But the hospital paid a management fee to this company, and they paid the salary of the CEO, and the CEO sent regular reports. The CEO was actually based. He was from Ottawa. He was bilingual. It wasn't an American that came up and, you know, tried to tell us how to run things. What it did do that I think actually was very valuable, and I didn't understand the value of it until after the fact, was it gave the CEO somebody to report to that could see through him. To be an effective manager, one of the skills that effective managers need to have is they have to be able to manipulate people. For good or for bad, they need to be able to do that or they can't do their job. And it was quite fascinating because he was a master at that. We would have think tanks for the board of directors, and he would have been talking to me about something for months and months and months, and how he wanted to do something. He would take it to the board of directors, and at the end of this think tank, not only would the members of the board of directors be agreeing with them, they all thought it was their own idea.
Yeah,
it was fascinating, but a little scary at the same time. And having this oversight that he had to report to meant he was reporting to somebody that could actually see through all this. And I really didn't appreciate the value of that. We ended up severing the contract early, actually, because, you know, we were paying far more for this management contract than the CEO's salary. And so on the surface, it didn't seem to make much sense. But I don't think anybody appreciated the value of that oversight.
So take me again then from your your role as an emergency physician to discovery of cannabis medicine. And when was the first time you heard about cannabis as a medicine?
Well, that was by accident, a fortuitous accident. I thought I would finish my career in the emergency department. I thought this was my home. But then some changes were made, with implications for the department that I could not live with. So I naively thought that I could fix it, that I could fight this, which made me the target. And I stayed there for 2 years, another 2 years, bringing it to a total of almost 30 years as well. And but it just became unbearable. The environment was so toxic, and it's like, I have to get out of here. I will wash dishes at McDonald's if I have to, but I have to get out of here. And I didn't really want to wash dishes at McDonald's. So I pulled out the classified section of the Medical Post, and right at the top, opening soon in Ottawa, Cannabinoid Medical Clinic. It's like, well, that sounds interesting. I had no clue how interesting it would be. The typical trajectory for an emergency physician is either when they no longer want to do the shifts, they'll maybe get into research, they maybe get into management, they might go work in a walk-in clinic. I wasn't interested in any of those things. And it's like, if I'm going to leave the emergency room, I want to do something completely different. And then I started learning about cannabis, and the clinic hadn't opened yet. So I did have a little bit of time to start learning about it. And the first thing that struck me is that cannabis doesn't kill people. And I was like, wait a minute, cannabis doesn't kill people. And I'd never put it together before. In the emergency room, you know, we're used to calling poison control. Anytime we get somebody come in with a proverbial bad trip, call poison control, or there's nothing to worry about, let them sleep it off, and we give them something to sedate them, let them sleep for a few hours. It was usually a him. Then a few hours later, they'd wake up and be able to head home. And there was never anything worse than that. And from a coroner's perspective, the worst thing I ever saw, there were a few deaths that were in some way related to cannabis, but to basically the illegal nature of it, and involving things like AK-47s, there was never a death because of the cannabis itself.
Did you say AK-47s?
Yeah, they're a prohibited
for real
weapon.
Oh my goodness!
In the country, by the way. So,
wow.
So, that's
well outside of my framework of knowledge. Look, Dr. Mainville, Dr. Barb, to go from an emergency physician who's seeing mostly guys come in over intoxicated from cannabis, and say it's a poison control issue, to seeing an ad in the paper for a medical cannabis clinic. I mean, I guess my question to you is the legitimacy of cannabis as a medicine. Where did you make the leap, or how did you? I mean, did you just decide to start learning about medical cannabis on the job, or did you doubt the efficacy of medical cannabis? How do you go from being a physician in an emergency room where it's not viewed like most doctors as a medicine at all, to now going to a clinic to actually dispense it?
Well, basically, I burned my bridge. There was no going back. And so it's okay. Like, okay, I have to learn about this stuff. I really don't. Working in a walk-in clinic holds absolutely no interest for me. There's no going back. Medical cannabis at that point, that was late 2015, early 2016. Medical cannabis had been legal in California since 1996 at that point. I knew there was something to it, but I really didn't know any of the details. So the first thing that struck me is it doesn't kill people. And it's like, wait a minute, there's something out there that we can use to help people that doesn't kill them. Why aren't we using this more? And then as I progressed further, I came across the very important piece of information that the main purpose of our endocannabinoid system, our own internal endocannabinoid system, we make our own cannabis-like substances, and the main purpose of the system is to maintain homeostasis. It's all about keeping all our other systems in balance and running smoothly. It's basically all about keeping us normal and healthy. And it's like, this is really important. And
it is really important. Yes. Okay. So when on your journey did you discover the endocannabinoid system? Because I'm sure you didn't learn about that in medical school.
Absolutely not. No, it was after I decided to leave the emergency department and started delving into cannabis. And there are more resources available now than there were in 2015, but the resources that were available were mainly based in California, not surprising. But I just dove in, and I forget exactly where I came across this piece of information, but it was fairly early on, and it's like, whoa. And that was when I was totally hooked. It's like, this is interesting. And
were you aware of Professor Raphael Mechoulam's research? In Israel, he's the one who discovered, or his team discovered, the endocannabinoid system and THC and CBD. Were you aware of his research back in?
I became aware
middle of the 20s.
Yeah, once I started looking into it, certainly I became aware of his research really quite early on. Wonderful research coming out of Israel. Unfortunate, we lost Dr. Mechoulam about a year ago now, almost exactly a year ago. His story is quite interesting. The work he was doing was actually, he was working with confiscated cannabis. He would go from the university to the police station
an incredible story.
But then he
on
would,
the bus.
Yes, he would take
on the bus.
Public
he would,
transit.
He would go from the public transit. People would smell it. It's legal.
Yep. So very grateful for all the work that he did and the advancement of the science. And certainly reading his research is fascinating. One of the things that struck me as I learned more about this is there is so much preclinical work done on this. There is so much that we know about the endocannabinoid system, but doing research on people, doing actually prospective randomized controlled research on people is next to impossible.
Why is that?
Because you can't get the study approved. And it's...
Why not?
Well, that's a really good question. People have been using cannabis. There is evidence that human beings have been using cannabis for over 10,000 years. So this is not a new substance for people. I'm pretty sure that if cannabis was going to do something horrible to people, we would know it by now. But the politics around cannabis are just so complex. And there's so many parties withstanding, so to speak, using coroner's phrasing. There are so many influences that are not being declared. And we have this mountain of research. We have people who have been using cannabis since 2018, October 2018. Every adult in Canada has legal access to cannabis. But you would think that once it was legalized, that would make research easier. But it has not. And it's like,
It's not. But it's been over five years now.
Yep.
And it's still difficult to research just the simple endocannabinoid system and the effect of cannabinoids on the system and on the body. That sounds bizarre to me. Who do I need to talk to get this through? I mean, it just sounds impossible.
Well,
that's the way it is right now. But maybe you can, from your knowledge of the current studies and just, I want to drill down just a little bit more into, because I know, but a lot of people listening maybe already know about the endocannabinoid system. But for those who don't, what exactly is the endocannabinoid system? I know the circulatory system, and, you know, I studied a bit of biology. You know, we got the respiratory system and the skeletal system, but the endocannabinoid system, it sounds a little bit like the magical system. What is it?
Well, as you can imagine, any system that is responsible for keeping all the other systems of the body in balance and running smoothly is incredibly complex. And I'm certainly not going to pretend to be an expert on the tiny details of it. Just very broadly, we do make our own cannabis-like substances. We have receptors basically everywhere in our body, with the exception of our brainstem, the respiratory center in our brainstem. And that's why cannabis doesn't kill people. I'm talking about the part of the brain that tells us to breathe. There are a lot of opioid receptors at that level of the brain, and that's why opioids do kill people. Somebody who has an overdose of opioids just stops breathing, they die very peacefully and very happily, and typically rather tragically young, unfortunately. But there are no endocannabinoid receptors at that level of the brain, but they are everywhere else, including on the mitochondria inside the cells. The mitochondria, on an evolutionary basis, were actually ancient bacteria, and there are endocannabinoid receptors on the surface of the mitochondria. They really are everywhere. And one of the things that's quite fascinating is we form the endocannabinoid substances and these receptors on demand and as we need them. And that whole system is a fat-based system. So we need our body, for the system to work properly, we need the appropriate building blocks. We need healthy fats in our diet to supply these building blocks so the endocannabinoid system can work properly. And
remind me what healthy fats are again. Are we talking avocado?
Avocado, fatty fish.
Mackerel, right?
Yeah. Nuts, nuts and seeds, olive oil, the Mediterranean diet. One of the big reasons why the Mediterranean diet is so good for us is because it includes a very nice amount of these healthy fats. But of course, for four decades, the medical profession was telling people, nope, fats are bad. Chocolate milk, you're better drinking chocolate milk than you are drinking whole milk because it's only 1% fat instead of 3.25%. And the sugar's right, not a problem.
Right.
a friend of mine actually spent a term as the president of the American College of Cardiology, the ACC. Fred right. Beauvais, brilliant man, just absolutely brilliant. His wife was a nurse, and she was so frustrated because Fred insisted on eating white bread. And it's like, Fred, there's no nutrition in this. Yes, but there's only 70 calories a slice. And I was like, Fred, it's about more than the calories. It's about the nutrition. We just got people so, first of all, we got them hooked on a low-fat, high-sugar diet. Riley Cote once came out with the comment that high-fructose corn syrup should be a Schedule I drug, and I completely agree with him on that.
Right.
We haven't heard from Riley for a while, but just love the work that he's doing. So we got people hooked on a high, low fat, high sugar diet, you know, just, you know, doing untold damage to their endocannabinoid system. And we basically gave the message that as long as it's low fat, it's okay. And so people, we stopped talking about nutrition. People stopped paying attention to nutrition. The president of the American College of Cardiology stopped thinking about nutrition. And
okay, but so what, when you said it damages the endocannabinoid system, so say you have a low fat, high sugar diet, what is that actually doing to your endocannabinoid system then?
Well, you're by not providing the building blocks that the body needs to form these receptors and these substances, you're interfering with the body's ability to maintain homeostasis, to maintain balance. And then the endocannabinoid system, by the way, is the system that's responsible for release of cytokines. The substance is responsible for inflammation. Cytokines in the body are regulated by the endocannabinoid system. And then you throw in sugar, which is pro-inflammatory. So you're throwing in a pro-inflammatory substance while you're crippling the system that regulates inflammation. And you're basically creating an inflammatory machine. And when I was training, I don't know, I mean, we didn't know about cytokines at that point. And we did know that people that were overweight were at increased risk of heart disease. And on a very simplistic level, I don't remember if somebody actually told me this, but certainly the way I figured it out was, well, of course, people have fat everywhere else. They have fat blocking their coronary arteries. Not really a surprise. But what it turns out is that the plaques are actually caused by inflammation. Fat tissue produces hormones that create inflammation. And so by giving people a lot of sugar, which is pro-inflammatory, crippling their system that regulates inflammation, giving them lots of sugar, basically creating an obesity epidemic, you're not reducing heart disease, you're increasing it.
Okay. What about stuff like, you know, crackers or cookies? So cookies have sugar, but what about crackers that are maybe, you know, rice-based, that don't have any sugar on them? And, my wife and I, we sometimes eat some cheese and crackers. Is that an example of a thing that we shouldn't be eating, or?
No, crackers are relatively benign. The basic soda cracker has pretty limited nutrition, but if you have, for instance, crackers made with whole grains, they're pretty benign. It's sugar that's the big thing that you want to be sure to limit. And, you know, you look at breakfast cereals and the sugary content of the breakfast cereals that are marketed for children. It's like, you know, start crippling their endocannabinoid system early.
Early. Yeah. We have Fruit Loops here. So I know about that. We try and limit the Fruit Loops, and actually the kids, they don't really like the Fruit Loops all that much, to be honest with you. Too much sugar, I think they detect it right away. Okay. So I want to dive into homeostasis just a little bit more with respect to other organs and other diseases. For example, diabetes. You know, if it's sugar related, are there endocannabinoid receptors on the pancreas, in the stomach, the digestive system? How does How does the endocannabinoid system and the onset of diabetes, how do they interact? Do you know about that?
Okay, so there's two main types. It's not quite as simple as we thought initially, but there are two main types of diabetes. Type 1, which is very obviously an autoimmune disorder. It's the juvenile, typically the juvenile onset diabetes, where a child is normal and healthy and they get sick typically with some sort of a virus. And then they just never really recover, and they're subsequently diagnosed with diabetes. And most of those people, their pancreas is no longer producing any insulin at all, and they do not respond to any of the medications by mouth. They are dependent on insulin replacement from the get-go. The second type of diabetes, type 2, is typically related to obesity and insulin resistance. And there's the endocannabinoid system is involved at a lot of different levels. First of all, it one of the things that it modulates is the immune system. For instance, by giving somebody CBD, you're helping to push their immune system towards normal. If they have an underactive immune system, it lifts it up towards normal. If somebody has an overactive immune system, it pushes down towards normal. The endocannabinoid system is modulating the immune system. So, an endocannabinoid system that's not functioning properly is not going to be able to control that. The endocannabinoid system controls the hormones that that are involved with appetite that tell us when we're full. An endocannabinoid system that's not working properly, people can just keep eating and eating and eating without ever feeling like they've had enough. And the movement of electrolytes, calcium and electrolytes in and out of cells is moderated by the endocannabinoid system. When glucose moves, the potassium moves with it. And there's a lot of different levels at which a poorly functioning endocannabinoid system is going to increase the likelihood of somebody developing type 2 diabetes. So, right. Then it gets worse and worse and worse because they're used to eating a low-fat, high-sugar diet, and it just goes on from there.
So it sounds like a first step to tackling health and just in general is a high-fat diet, low-sugar, with supplements of CBD to reduce inflammation. Is that safe to summarize?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say high-fat, but a diet that's got a good amount of healthy fats. I don't want people going out and thinking, oh, I need to eat greasy pizza. Greasy pizza is going to make me healthy. It's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. Essentially a Mediterranean.
That's the wrong fat.
That's right. A Mediterranean type diet with a good amount of healthy fats, a good amount of fresh fruits and vegetables, a very limited amount of processed food. Get away, like really limit the amount of processed food. Limit the amount of refined carbohydrates. Carbohydrates aren't necessarily evil. It's the highly refined ones that are the problem. So limit the amount of carbohydrates. Not necessarily avoid them completely, but don't eat white bread. Have whole grains and rolled oats. Go with the ones that are the least processed, either the basic rolled oats, or even better would be steel cut oats, really minimize the processing of what you're eating, and have a diet. We are what we eat, and if we want our endocannabinoid system to be healthy, then we need to start there. And one of the things that I find frustrating is the medical profession as a group tends to dismiss the endocannabinoid system. Oh, I don't believe in that. It's like, what? Because they are so biased against cannabis, they don't even acknowledge the existence of the endocannabinoid system. And there are ways of working with the endocannabinoid system that have nothing to do with being intoxicated or impaired.
Do you know where the bias against cannabis in the medical profession came from? I mean, I remember doing a little bit of research from the previous turn of the century, in the late 1800s, where every pharmaceutical company had its own cannabis tincture, right? And it didn't progress into the 1900s. And then when we got the legislation against cannabis in 1923, you know, it was obviously not going to be on the doctor's list of remedies. But where we got this bias for our medical community?
Yeah, that came out of the group that became the DEA in the United States. In the United States, I forget the exact years, they had prohibition of alcohol, and which was absolutely a failed experiment. The guy in charge of the group that policed alcohol prohibition was then looking at not only himself being unemployed, but all the people that worked for him were going to be unemployed because there was no longer going to be alcohol prohibition. And so he said, well, you know, I can't let these people go hungry. You know, we're talking about the Depression, and we need to find a job for these people. So we need something else for them to do. And at that point, jobs in the US were a little scarce, the Great Depression, and there were migrant workers coming up from Mexico. And so these evil migrant workers were interpreted as taking jobs away from poor, starving Americans. So he decided, well, isn't this a perfect fit? We're going to demonize these migrant workers who are using what previously been called cannabis. And it's like, they call it marijuana, we're going to call it marijuana. And we're going to demonize this stuff, and we're going to make it prohibited. And although the prohibition of alcohol had been a failed experiment, we're just going to do it with this. And until then, cannabis was actually a very useful tool in the medical toolbox. And when I told my mother, a little sidebar here, when I told my mother that I was going into this field of medicine, I had no idea how she would react. I'd never used the stuff when I was younger. We'd never had a conversation about it, but I knew I had to tell her. And so I just came out with it, and she was kind of quiet and paused. And she said, you know, when I was a young girl, and it was when she was a teenager, it was in the 1940s. She was born in 1932 and uses CBD regularly, by the way. But when she was a teenager, she said, you know, I used to go and visit my grandmother, and my grandmother had asthma. And I would go over, and sometimes my grandmother would be sitting at the table, and there'd be a bowl on the table, and there'd be something burning in this bowl, and she'd be leaning over it with a towel over her head. And it was something that her doctor told her to use to help her with her asthma. And it did. It helped with her asthma. Grandma would use this stuff, and then her would settle her asthma down, and she would be able to get on with her day. It was only many, many, many years later that my mother smelled cannabis and realized that the sweet scent she's associated with grandma's house was actually cannabis. So even though...
Amazing.
Even though prohibition...
Your grandmother was... Sorry, your grandmother was burning cannabis in a bowl in her kitchen.
My mother's grandmother.
Your great-grandmother.
My great-grandmother. And so even though prohibition technically came in the 1920s, this was in the 1940s. And when she needed more, she would go to the drugstore and fill her prescription from her doctor and get more cannabis to use to help her with her asthma. So cannabis.
This is in Hawkesbury?
No. It was in Southern Ontario somewhere. I forget exactly where, but not in Hawkesbury.
So even though we had prohibition, she could still go get it from a pharmacist or
somewhere. And the big stigma, the whole prohibition thing was never because doctors didn't want it. The stigma didn't really come into play until the 1970s and Nixon's war on drugs. I found out recently that cocaine was not illegal, at least in California, until 1983. 1983 really? Was when cocaine became illegal in California. But
that's surprising. In Canada, it was 1911. It's crazy. Yeah. That's so bizarre.
It was Nixon's war on drugs that really kicked things up a ramp.
Definitely,
and
yes.
really villainized the stuff. And the medical profession has, most people practicing have grown up being told that cannabis is bad. That's what everybody around them has told them, is that cannabis is bad. And so that's what they believe. And it is much harder to tell people something, or it's much easier to tell people something new than it is to tell them that something they've always believed is wrong. And so if somebody were to come down from the Himalayas tomorrow and say, I found this amazing plant and it does all these things and it works with the system of the body responsible for keeping us healthy, people would be all over it. The fact that that plant has already been identified and it happens to be called cannabis changes everything.
So it's really a marketing thing. That's what it sounds like it comes down to, is how do we market this in a way that people can understand its efficacy. It reminds me of what you just said, reminds me of the craze of all these new berries, like the acai berry or the goji berry or the late, whatever new thing they've discovered you can put into a smoothie and you drink every day and you're 10 years younger. So cannabis seems to be like that. And maybe we need a rediscovery. Maybe we need to call it something different. I don't know. One of your specialties, I understand, is pediatrics and cannabis. Is that something that evolved from working in the clinic, or how did that?
Yeah, it's an unofficial specialty. Working with cannabis is not a recognized specialty within medicine, but I certainly have developed an expertise with cannabis, and over the years I've developed some degree of relative expertise working with children. I do have certainly a lot of children in my practice.
What are some of the ailments that parents come to you with to help, to get some help?
Autism would be the big one. Seizures, ADHD, anxiety. Fortunately, I have not seen any pediatric cancers, but I know occasionally they can present. I was peripherally involved with one years ago, but I haven't had any of my own, which after 30 years as a coroner and 30 years in the emergency room, I'm quite happy to leave those very sad and tragic cases to somebody else. Most of them are various degrees of autism. One young fellow was diagnosed with a dopamine deficiency, and he's now doing very, very well with CBD. So that's really a pleasure, and it looks like he will be able to actually achieve his potential, which is actually looking like it's quite considerable. It's a real pleasure to assist those children.
Are you able to tell me a bit about how parents and the child discovers the right dose of CBD and that journey of figuring out what works? Because I hear that it's a lot of trial and error, just like in the medical profession, you try a whole bunch of different drugs to try and treat something, and you need to experience the failure and say, okay, that doesn't work. What about this? So what's it like with the CBD journey of that?
Well, with CBD, there's no standardized dosing, and we don't really understand why. You know, is absorption in an issue? Maybe. Is it, you know, some people have better functioning endocannabinoid systems than others? That's probably part of the puzzle. We really don't understand why the dosing is so variable from person to person. I've been working with cannabis for over 8 years now, and the only pattern that, if you could call it that, that I've been able to pick out is that now and then I'll have people that tell me that that they're sensitive to all medications. They're super sensitive to all medications. They take teeny tiny baby doses of any medication. And very often the people that say that respond to teeny tiny doses of CBD. I wouldn't want to try THC with them at all, but I do have a small handful of patients that basically use a drop of CBD oil once or twice a day. And for those patients, it's been absolutely life-changing.
Can you tell me how? So like your case of the child with autism, what's the life-changing part?
Well, I mean, they come with different issues, and so, you know, the benefits can vary from person to person. It does seem to come back to an enzymatic deficiency in the P450 system. They don't break down the medications the way other people do. And so a much smaller dose goes much further with them. But yeah, they basically get the same benefit that other people might get for the similar condition, but other people taking a much larger amount of a similar product. So it's the life-changing part depends on their, you know, what they're being treated for. But the reason they respond to such a small amount seems to come back to enzymatic deficiencies at the level of the P450 system in the liver. I have one patient who uses 750 milligrams of CBD a day. That's what works for him. Fortunately, it's being paid for by Veterans Affairs. Most people wouldn't be able to afford that. So I have patients going from a milligram or two a day to, the 750 milligrams a day is an absolute outlier. Probably most of my patients are more in the 100 milligram a day-ish range. We really don't understand why there's such variability. It doesn't seem to vary. It doesn't go by age or weight or gender or condition or any of the kidney function, liver function doesn't seem to be related to any of those normal things that we'll look at with other medications when we're trying to decide on dosing. So what we do is we start with a very small amount and have the person gradually increase until they start noticing benefit. And then once they're getting the benefit, that's the amount that they should be taking.
There's a documentary from 2013, Dr. Sanjay Gupta in the States made called Weeds, which chronicles the story of Charlotte Figi, who is a young child, a girl with epilepsy, seizures every day, all the time. It was dramatic, life-changing effect. None of the drugs worked, but she took drops of what's now called Charlotte's Web, this high potency of high dose CBD oil, and seizure-free mostly. And that same medicine, Charlotte's Web, produced in Colorado, is effective for Dr. Jennifer Anderson's child, Nicholas, in Winnipeg. And there's a documentary about him. So I'm researching for my own documentary about a young boy in Nebraska. And it's particularly discouraging to see what's happening in Nebraska in the States, because it's completely illegal, except for possession of small amounts. But this child, Colton Eggers, cannot get access to Charlotte's Web for his epileptic seizures. Are you aware of other children who have epilepsy in your practice or in Canada who are benefiting from Charlotte's Web, and why? What do you know? What helps? How does it take away the seizures? How does it prevent the seizures?
Okay, yeah, I believe Charlotte's Web is now available in Canada. I know that Charlotte's Angel, which is a related to Charlotte's Web, is related. You need to realize that any cannabis plant has over 500 compounds in it. We talk about CBD, we talk about THC, but there's a lot of other substances as well. There's over 200 terpenes. They're the substances that give the cannabis its scent and its flavor, but they also do stuff to us. They give the whole aromatherapy essential oil thing that's so popular comes back to terpenes. There's about 150 cannabinoid substances. We are starting to learn about a few of them, and now things like CBG and CBN can be accessed fairly easily on the market. But most of those substances we don't really understand. And Charlotte's Web does seem to be and there's about 25 flavonoids, which give the cannabis its color. And two of the cannaflavins, unique to the cannabis plant, have been found to have anti-inflammatory properties, about 30 times the anti-inflammatory activity of aspirin, ASA. So you've got all these substances combined in the plant, and certainly Charlotte's Web does seem to be a very helpful combination, but not necessarily the only combination that that can help these children. And it's not clear exactly why. I know I do have one child in my practice who responds really well to the CBD oil that was produced by CanTrust. It was a wonderful product, very high in the terpene caryophyllene, a little bit of myrcene. And CanTrust, just such an unfortunate story and a warning. In case people aren't familiar with it, it was one of the early companies in the industry. Wonderful products, award-winning products. The people running the company, not the shareholders, but the people making the day-to-day decisions, got a little too big for their britches and decided that Health Canada rules didn't apply to them. And they started growing in two grow rooms that were not yet licensed. Those rooms subsequently were licensed, but Health Canada, when they found out that they had started growing in them before they were licensed, really took exception to this and basically shut them down. And the arrogant people in charge, it's like, oh, not a problem. We'll just let this blow over and we'll sell off the assets and then start up a new company and no problem. Well, then they realized they really couldn't sell the assets. Nobody wanted the baggage. And so it's like, oh, we have to get serious about this. They spent a good while on their knees groveling and finally got back in the good graces of Health Canada and got back into business, marketing the very same product they originally had, instead of under the CanTrust name, marketing as Astora. And this child had been doing very, very well on CanTrust CBD oil, but there was this gap when they could not access it. And they tried basically everything else possible on the market at the time and were not able to get comparable seizure control. And so they were absolutely delighted when the product became available again, marketed under Astora. And now that Astora just was never able to get back the market share that they had, they were never able to get back on their feet. And unfortunately, they shut down. And so my patient's parents have been able to access leftover stock of this product, but I'm really not sure what we're going to do when that runs out. So it's absolutely can be very strain specific, but it doesn't necessarily have to be Charlotte's Web. Charlotte's Web is just an example of one that does seem to be effective for a lot of people. And I'm glad that it's working for Jennifer's son. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, there's a filmmaker, Chase Guthrow, did a documentary about Dr. Anderson and Nicholas, and it's excellent. I think, got a couple of awards across the country. 40-minute documentary, and I think everybody should see it.
She was one of our guests.
He chronicles four children.
Okay.
She was, exactly, that's where I first heard of her. The filmmaker chronicles four different children who have different ailments. One of them is autism, a very severe case of autism, and it's amazing to see the change from using medical cannabis. And I shouldn't keep saying medical cannabis. Is there, in your opinion, a difference between recreational and medical cannabis? We're talking about the same plant. Is it just the way that it's marketed? What in your opinion, what's the big deal or difference?
The products themselves are regulated in the same manner. So they're all federally regulated, quality controlled. So some people do come to the medical side because they say, I just feel like the products are better. Certainly just when it comes to quality control, that is not particularly true. What is true, though, is that on the recreational market, CBD has no recreational applications. So all the shops that are selling recreational cannabis are selling for people who want to use it recreationally. And so very often they don't carry any of the CBD products. There just isn't the market for it. So, and the ones that do might be hit or miss. It might be available at one point and then not available when they go back for it. So people who are looking to use cannabis as a medicine, one of the things they need is consistent supply. And so by going through the medical channels, first of all, the big difference is that you're getting the medical guidance. But then if you're using most of the medical patients are on treatment plans that are heavy with CBD, and for that to be consistently available, it's better to go through a medical licensed producer. I do have some patients. Well, I've had some patients who end up really using mainly THC, which is easily accessible on the recreational market. And they decide that, once they've learned about it and they know how to choose products appropriately, they end up purchasing primarily from the recreational market. Some of them stay with the medical clinics just because they like to touch base every year and find out if there's anything new and that might be helpful for them. Some of them just let things lapse and say, thank you so much for your help. But if I need to talk to you again, I'll contact the clinic. And I have no problem with that. For most medical patients, it comes down to the guidance and the availability.
Do you think that the current system to regulate medical cannabis is helping patients, or are there ways that you see in your practice that regulation could be changed to benefit patients more?
Well, one of the issues is that there is very often a price differential between cannabis on the medical side and cannabis on the recreational side. Now, some products are just not available on the recreational side. So if they want it, they need to go on the medical side. But I don't understand why there is that price differential. And sometimes it can be quite extreme, even for the exact same product. Tweed, medically marketed as Spectrum, but there's still some Tweed products out there. They ended up using Tweed to market their more their recreational products. But they have an oil spray called Penelope, and which is a really nice product, quite cost effective, just overall. If somebody is buying that from the Spectrum medical site, it is being sold for $55 plus tax. If they happen to qualify, they might get a discount from that. But if you go to the OCS.ca website, the Ontario Cannabis Store provincial website, that exact same product is being sold for $25 taxes in.
Half price, less than half.
Yeah, and it's like, right. I don't understand. So And my understanding is that one of the reasons is the tax structure for the licensed producers. There's really a lot of financial stress on the licensed producers. They've really been struggling. A lot of them are selling a lot of products on the recreational side to kind of buoy up their medical side. But yeah, whatever it is in the legislation that is creating that price differential, I think needs to be examined, and something a little more consistent. I've had patients that say, I just can't afford the medical prices. I'm buying it from the recreational shop, and it's like, well, it's probably better than not getting any. Certainly with regards to other medications, I have patients who will take prescription medications, even prescription opioids, because they're covered. And they've tried cannabis. They much prefer the cannabis, but when nuts come to bolts, they just can't afford to pay for it. And so it's particularly sad when there's a patient who's doing well on cannabis, they have to go back to the pharmaceuticals that they didn't like taking before. They didn't like the side effects of them before. They basically are in a situation where they have no choice. Their insurance companies cover these pharmaceuticals that are often much more expensive, they won't cover the medical cannabis. And I think that's particularly unfortunate. So I would like to see some changes with the coverage as well.
Before this interview, you sent me a paper released by the Journal of the American Heart Association. The title is Association of Cannabis Use with Cardiovascular Outcomes Among U.S. Adults. And the conclusion was that cannabis use is associated with adverse cardiovascular outcomes, with heavier use, more days per month, associated with higher odds of adverse outcomes. Why'd you send me this? And how do you want to frame this discussion?
Okay. Well, the title of this paper, anybody who reads through the abstract, is going to tend to be rather alarmed by it. So I think it deserves being put into perspective. I can certainly see patients or potential patients coming across this and maybe not seeking medical cannabis when perhaps it could benefit them, or if they're already taking it, you know, just stopping using it. I can see doctors coming across this, and it's like, oh my God, I can't let my patients use cannabis. And I think that would be a really unfortunate misinterpretation of this data. I think this data does provide a very useful correction to the recreational market. There does seem to be this idea on the recreational market that cannabis is safe. And as recreational substances go, relatively speaking, it is. That doesn't mean that it's safe to use as much of it as you want. You know, even water, if you drink too much water, it will kill you. So don't do that. Too much THC is not good for you. Don't do that. Does that mean we should stop drinking water? No. Does that mean we should disregard THC as a therapeutic modality? No. But it means that we shouldn't overuse this. So I think it is useful in that sense. Now, it is a retrospective study looking back. And just historically speaking, anybody who's been using cannabis for any significant length of time started out on the illegal market. And, you know, perhaps some of the people involved in the study are still using illegal cannabis, and you have to take into account that those substances in a large number of cases are not well, in the U.S., none of it's federally regulated. Certainly, the quality control would be very, very variable. And so the quality of the product is questionable as well. What it comes down to mainly is the smoking of THC. And when we're looking to use cannabis medically, THC absolutely has its therapeutic applications. And even smoked cannabis can, in certain circumstances, be a valid form of treatment. But one of the things that's nice about legalization is that it has really allowed the development of alternative delivery formats. And so we have a growing selection of ways that the THC can be delivered without having the person smoke. And so I think I can quite safely speak for all physicians working with medical cannabis, and that we do try and keep smoked THC to a minimum. But we do accept that there, in some cases, it is what the patient is going to be using, but we do as much as possible try and substitute other modalities. And another thing about this is that in the United States, they have legally separated the hemp industry from the cannabis industry. Mm-hmm. So essentially what that means is, in the United States, when they're talking about cannabis, they're talking about THC. Whereas in Canada, when we're talking about cannabis, we're talking about THC and CBD. So you have to realize that there's that distinction as well. And I think this study does serve a purpose, but it needs to be kept in perspective, and it's not a reason to not use medical cannabis. One of the things that frustrates me is that physicians will say, well, there's no long-term data about the safety of cannabis. And so the then obvious reply is, well, show me the long-term data for what you have the patient on already. And it doesn't exist. Physicians in the 21st century like to talk about evidence-based medicine. And very often they'll say, oh, I can't let my patient use cannabis. I believe in evidence-based medicine. I have not seen the evidence that cannabis is safe on a long-term basis. And but they don't apply the same test to what they're doing already. And
How so? What do you mean by that? The physicians are not applying the same test of long-term based evidence to cannabis?
The test that they're applying to cannabis, like they'll say, you know, I haven't seen evidence that that long-term use of cannabis is safe. I'm going to continue to prescribe these stimulants to my pediatric patient with ADHD. And it's like, okay, so where is the evidence that the stimulant is safe on a long-term basis used in a pediatric age group? Well, that evidence,
there isn't,
it doesn't exist. And they say, well, you know, it's been studied. It's like, well, how long have those studies been for? Well, 6 weeks, 12 weeks. And how long have you had this patient on the stimulant? Oh, 5 years already. And so it is important to look for the evidence, evaluate the quality of the evidence, weigh the source of that evidence. Is it conflicted? The 4 years of low-fat, high-sugar diet, it turns out, was based on studies that were funded by the sugar industry. So it's very important to know where this evidence is coming from. And physicians are busy. Nobody's going to try and argue against that. Physicians are busy, and some of them have a personal interest, and they take the time to learn about cannabis. It's not being taught in medical schools. But very often they just turn to the Canadian Medical Association. What's the CMA saying? And the CMA is saying there's not enough proof, there's not enough evidence. Well, to interpret that, you have to realize where the CMA is coming from. And the CMA is not funded by membership dues. I was quite surprised to realize that the CMA, only 18% of Canadian physicians are actually members of the Canadian Medical Association. And membership dues are $100 a year. They're not funding their activities through membership dues. The CMA is being funded by Big Pharma. One gift a few years ago, I don't know how... This is just one example. Pfizer gave the CMA a gift of $800,000 for education. Well, that wasn't for education about cannabis. And the CMA knows who butters their bread, and they're not going to do anything to in any way harm their good friends in Big Pharma. So they are not going to say anything against or anything in favor of cannabis until the cannabis industry starts giving them similar gifts.
Is there a real threat to the pharmaceutical? Is cannabis a real threat to the pharmaceutical industry? Are the pharmaceutical executives shaking in their boots because people like yourself and Dr. Anderson and other physicians are now seeing the value in medical cannabis and seeing the turnaround in patients? Is this just going to collapse the pharmaceutical industry? I mean, what's the fear?
No, it's not going to collapse them. I am, by the way, a big fan of immunizations. Ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. I have seen the changes in the pediatric medicine landscape over the course of my career, thanks to the development of new vaccinations. I am a big fan of vaccinations, and Pfizer has done very well recently in that regard. The cannabis is not going to put the pharmaceutical industries out of business, cannabis can definitely potentially affect the bottom line for Big Pharma. And the pharmaceutical industry, I can't even begin to imagine the millions and millions of dollars involved every year. We're probably talking about billions. They don't want to see any decrease in that. It's not an
So you see it as a threat. Obviously, it's a threat, obviously. Yeah. If cannabis can assist or replace some leading drugs for various ailments and, different combinations of cannabinoids, and as this research progresses, why can't pharmaceutical companies embrace it? I mean, we have Epidiolex, we have, I think it's 3 cannabis-based medicines already. Can't we see that expand to hundreds? I mean, what about that possibility?
The plant is difficult to work with. There's just so many compounds in it. Epidiolex, by the way, is not legal for use in Canada. It's a U.S. thing, and it's ridiculously expensive. In Canada, we do have Sativex. There are differences in what's available between Canada and the U.S. Canada, we have Nabilo. In the U.S., they have Dronabinol. Both are synthetic THC analogs, but a little bit different. But certainly the pharmaceutical industry is funding a lot of the preclinical research. They're trying to figure out ways to work with the endocannabinoid system to, come up with a drug that they can then market, and the medical profession will be all on board with, without resorting to the plant itself. The actual research within the pharmaceutical industry using the actual cannabis plant, I think GW Pharm is pretty much the only one that's actively working with that. A lot of other companies are trying to develop drugs, for instance, that block the FAW, the fatty acid amide hydrolase, FAAH, the FAW, that breaks down the anandamide, which is sort of our natural THC-like substance, to a large part responsible for the runner's high, by the way. Tylenol, one of the ways that Tylenol helps make people feel better is it blocks the FAW. So the person's anandamide level increases. And one of the potential reactions to the importance of the endocannabinoid system, especially when it comes to pediatrics, is, if the system is so important, then we certainly shouldn't be messing with it with our precious children. And it's like, well, but you already are. If you're giving your child Tylenol, or if you're recommending that your patients give their children Tylenol, you're already messing with those children's endocannabinoid systems. So a lot of medications that are, well, I don't know a lot, some medications that are out there, Tylenol being the main example that I'm familiar with, do in some way work with the endocannabinoid system. It's one of the metabolites of Tylenol that blocks the FAW. They're looking at that type of thing. None of them have really got.
What about Advil? Is that a similar? I know Advil is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. That doesn't have the same action that Tylenol does, though, right?
No, it works by a different method. And the anti-inflammatories, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, NSAIDs, block all inflammation, including normal healing. Inflammation is the first step in the normal healing process. And a few years ago, orthopedic surgeons, getting worried about the opioid crisis, did a study where they started fixing people's fractures, sent them home with Tylenol and Advil. Well, these poor patients, not only was their pain miserably undertreated, the fractures actually didn't heal. The Advil was actually interfering with the ability to heal these fractures. So they ended up with a non-union. Yay. The most recent study that came out was that they've discovered that that the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories actually increases the development of chronic pain, which makes sense when you realize that you're blocking the ability for the injury to heal. So yes, it becomes chronic, and instead of hurting short-term, it hurts long-term. CBD, because it's working with the endocannabinoid system, is only blocking the excess inflammation without interfering with the normal healing process. So when they try and break it down, the endocannabinoid system is so complex and there's so much variability from person to person. If I have two patients with exactly the same issues, they could even be the same gender, the same age, the same weight. They might end up responding to very different products. But the endocannabinoid system is so complex that to isolate one component of it that works for everybody, without getting other people into trouble, it's very, very difficult to do. And by working with the cannabis,
ideally, what I could see, in the very, very distant future, Star Trek wise, is you have a scan of the body. It tells you exactly what kind of cannabis you need to be ingesting, and the modality, maybe whether it's inhaling it or eating it. It'd be ideal if we could have a body scan that just, like an MRI, just shows you instantly, okay, you need this, and here's where you get it, right? Isn't that, that would be phenomenal, wouldn't it?
Absolutely would be on my wish list. And at a very basic level, basically rehabbing people's endocannabinoid system by getting them onto a healthy diet is certainly a really good start. But all the research to get to such a magical machine is going to take a while. And so for now, we need to work with what we can work with. And So with medical cannabis, sometimes I have patients that respond especially well to specific terpenes, and they'll actually use a specific cannabis product, but then they'll supplement with some essential oils. It's at this point, it's really about tailoring the treatment to the individual. To be able to do that, you have to know what tools you're working with. And it's not just the substances, it's also the formats that are available in the marketplace. And most of the ingested formats are oil-based, which do go through the liver and potentially can interact with other medications, which sometimes can be issues. One of the recent products that's available on the market, we're starting to see some nano-emulsion drops, water-soluble drops. And those are absorbed differently. They start working a lot faster, more quickly. So you can gauge the dosing a little more easily than gauging the dosing with the oils. So far, very, very limited options on the marketplace. But I know there's at least one company that's working on a similar product, but preserves the terpenes and the minor cannabinoids. So we could then end up with basically strain-specific water-soluble drops. And so I'm really, really looking forward to the development of that technology, because then we won't have to worry about drug interactions at the level of the liver. Obviously, if somebody's taking a lot of psychiatric medication, a lot of THC on top of that, that certainly could cause issues regardless of how the THC is being absorbed. But the actual interaction at the level of the liver basically becomes a non-issue. And so we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But it's just so interesting and rewarding. Pretty much every day when I'm working, I have at least one patient tell me how much they appreciate what I've done to help them get their life back, essentially. One of the most extreme cases of that, one of my veterans, I was talking to him and he said, you know, and like, it was just such a pleasure to talk to him. He was telling me all the things he was doing and how much he's enjoying them. And I could just hear the life in his voice. And he said, you know, until I came to you and your clinic 2 years ago, he said, I spent 17 years just trying to figure out how I was going to get through the next 15 minutes. And so it's a really fascinating field of medicine. I think it's the future of medicine. How can you treat anything else if you don't? If you don't recognize the importance of the endocannabinoid system, CBD, by the way, just to balance the study by the AHA, CBD reduces the incidence of heart disease and reduces the incidence of arrhythmias. It stabilizes the nerve tissue that's telling the heart when it's supposed to beat, and by its modulation of the inflammatory system, it reduces the inflammation that results in those blockages in the coronary arteries. So CBD, this study is not talking about CBD. They're talking about smoked THC. CBD can actually be very beneficial for hearts. And I was very, very happy a little while ago. I was talking to one of my patients who had required bypass surgery. And he made no secret when he was at the Heart Institute in Ottawa, he made no secret that he was using cannabis and heavy on the CBD, but some THC. And he said, I was so pleasantly surprised. Nobody even so much as gave me the side eye.
That's progress. It sounds like progress.
It's progress, yeah. Acknowledging the existence of the endocannabinoid system and its importance, and starting to work with that, even if somebody, even if a physician is not convinced about the utility of medical cannabis, to encourage a diet that supports that helps support a healthy endocannabinoid system is a start. I'm sure they'll get there for the rest of it eventually, but there's just so much to be learned from this, and it is very frustrating because the even though the cannabis has been used by people for over 10,000 years, it has been legal for everybody over the age of majority across Canada for over 5 years now, going on five and a half, to actually get a prospective clinical study approved is next to impossible. It's really crazy.
Lots of room for improvement, obviously. Thank you for talking with me today and giving me all these fantastic stories, insight, all of your wisdom. There's obviously more areas to discuss, and so I think we should have a part two sometime. But I thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're most welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Cannabis Law in Canada. As you may guess, this interview is not legal advice. And if you need legal advice, please contact a lawyer. We're always working on making this the best podcast for our listeners. So if you have suggestions for an interview or ideas for episodes, please contact us at cannabislaw.ca.